Okay, welcome. You're listening to the Kraz Files podcast. It's Sunday the 7th of February 2016. This podcast is available from our website, which is krazfiles.com, C-R-A-Z-Z. Plenty of news links going up there, all sorts of stuff going up, and lots of our older podcasts as well. And you can have a listen to them on the website or download them. Subscribe via RSS feed. We're also over at iTunes, so you can get it over there. And we're on social media, on Facebook and stuff as well. Thanks for listening. Okay, we are plugged in and ready to go today. We're going to plunge right into it now with our guest. We've, of course, got Dr. Rima here, tirelessly here. She never stops. And also our other guest with us is from the Wollongong University. And it's a real pleasure to have you here, Brian Martin. Brian, how are you going? Welcome. Good to have you on the show with us this morning.
Thank you.
Brian, let's plunge right into this. Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and your blog and all that you do, as we talked about before we started. Let us know a little bit about your job at the university, and you got the floor. Lead us in a little bit to what happened with the situation with the thesis that got handed into the Wollongong University, showing what's going on in this country in regards to vaccines.
Okay, well, Judy Wileyman is a PhD student at the University of Wollongong, and I was her principal supervisor, and she graduated in December last year. And when the, you might say, the news that she'd graduated became public, there's the most extraordinary attack on her thesis, coordinated by campaigners that had been opposed to her for years. So perhaps to understand this a bit better, let me just tell you a bit about my background. Is for quite a few decades, I've been researching scientific controversies, you know, nuclear power, pesticides, fluoridation, and so forth. And one of the things I've been looking at is what I call suppression of dissent, which is when someone speaks out critical of the orthodox position or the dominant position, then they often come under attack, and scientists are especially vulnerable. They might be have their grants knocked back. They might have reprimands. They might even lose their jobs. So I've been researching this in a whole bunch of areas for a long time, and then I heard about, in Australia, the vaccination debate. And so what had happened is that there's, just like in lots of countries, there's a debate about vaccination. The dominant view is that vaccination is a good thing. It's one of the great contributions of medicine to human health. But there have always been a small number of critics. And these critics have carried on, and we had a usual sort of debate. You know, people say, yes, here's one view, here's a different view. No dramas. So that's nothing special. But then in 2009, there's a group set up which took a different angle. And this is a pro-vaccination group called Stop the Australian Vaccination Network.
Yeah.
So the Australian Vaccination Network was a vaccine critical group, which had been set up in the mid-1990s and carried on its sort of efforts in the usual sort of way, no dramas. But then this group stopped the Australian Vaccination Network, which was set up. It's used a different approach, which was to try and silence and discredit and in other ways harass and even destroy the Australian Vaccination Network and anyone else who openly criticized Australian government vaccination policy.
Yeah.
So when I heard about this, I thought, this is amazing. I've never heard about this anywhere else in the world, where you've got a group that's just presenting information about an issue and comes under such a furious attack. And so I decided to get involved with it. Now, so I've written a whole bunch of articles about the attack by Stop the Australian Vaccination Network, or SAVN for short, and documenting the methods that they use. And the most common methods are, first is basically trying to claim that their opponents have crazy ideas, you know, conspiracy theories and so forth. They use a whole bunch of complaints to government agencies. And another method they use quite a lot is to try and ridicule and humiliate people on the other side, for example, by taking screenshots of their comments and putting them on their Facebook page.
Yeah, yep.
So there's all of that going on, and I've been documenting that. Now, it's almost like by coincidence, I was at the same time I was supervising Judy Wileyman's PhD thesis. And so, and that was, I actually started doing that from 2007. That was before SAVN got going. Well, when SAVN got going, then Judy became one of their targets. She wasn't the main target. She wasn't directly involved with the AVN, but she was a target because she was speaking out in public, critical of vaccination. And so over a period of years, there's been a whole range of things done to try and discredit and derail Judy's PhD research, including a whole range of complaints to the university and the usual round of abusive comment on social media. And so it was not a surprise that when she graduated, when news of her graduation was going to become public, that the same people who had been attacking her for several years and been attacking any other open critic of vaccination would mount a big attack. The only thing that surprised me is the scale of the attack. And I might just mention some of the methods that were used. This way, the news of her graduating was made public on 11th of January. Within 24 hours, the people involved with SAVN, the opponents of anyone who criticizes vaccination, had fed a whole bunch of claims about Judy's thesis to the media, namely to journalists for The Australian. Now, I perhaps don't need to tell you, but a PhD thesis is usually a very long and detailed piece of work. And in my view, it's simply ludicrous to try and claim that within 24 hours, a person who's not in the field of the research can make any sensible comment as to whether, you know, what the quality of the research is. So I saw this immediately just as an attack, and certainly fits that sort of classification. So within 2 days later, there was a front page story in The Australian, the national newspaper, and a number of stories in following days, and then a whole bunch of blogs and abusive comment. And the strange thing here is that the abusive comment, not just about the thesis and about Judy, but also about me as a supervisor, criticisms of the external examiners for the thesis, who are the ones who judge its quality, and the university itself. To my mind, this is just totally ludicrous.
God.
But it also includes setting up a Wikipedia page, which gives a very one-sided treatment of what's going on. And there have been freedom of information requests to the university to get the identity of the examiners, which normally remain confidential. So there's a whole bunch of things being done to try and discredit this thesis. I might just comment that it seems very strange, to my mind, it seems very strange to pay so much attention to one PhD thesis.
Yeah, exactly.
I was going to suggest, Brian, that perhaps some in the audience have not read Judy's thesis, and perhaps you could summarize what it is that has evoked the ire of these critics.
Okay, well, there's two sides to this. I think what provokes their ire the most of all is that she has a PhD and that it's critical of vaccination. It doesn't really matter what's in it. They assume that it must be wrong and that everyone involved in it must be doing something dodgy. But just to tell you what the thesis covers, it's a critical examination of Australian government vaccination policy. And my view is that the key ideas that she presents, and it goes into a great amount of detail, is first that most of the deaths and serious illness from infectious diseases was declining very rapidly before the introduction of mass vaccination. So the implication is that mass vaccination was not the primary cause. It certainly could be considered to be one reason for decline, but it's not the primary cause of the major decline that happened earlier.
The hit a nerve, Brian?
Yeah. And so secondly, is that the World Health Organization has worked with an alliance called the Gavi Alliance, but to recommend vaccination policies which are pretty much standard for all countries in the world. Now, they're not all the same, of course, but basically Judy's argument is that this is a one-size-fits-all sort of recommendation for policy, and it's not taking into account the particular conditions in each country, because the conditions in Australia are going to be quite different from those in Zambia or Argentina or Serbia, whatever. Okay, that's the second main theme in her thesis. Third main theme is that a lot of the research on vaccination is either carried out by pharmaceutical companies or sponsored by them, and therefore there are very serious conflicts of interest. And there's a fair bit of research showing that when sponsorship of research can cause bias in the research. And then finally, and this is, you might say, the theoretical dimension of the thesis, she uses a concept called undone science. Now, undone science is, according to the sociologists who've developed this idea, is where there could be research done in a certain area, but because powerful groups might be worried that the research is going to be contrary to their interests, they don't fund it. So it ends up being undone, namely, the research isn't funded, or perhaps if it is carried out, it's not published, and so forth. So Judy looked in particular at the HPV vaccine and looked in detail at it, but also looked at the sort of things, the sort of research that could have been done on the HPV vaccine but hadn't been done. So those are four key elements in her research. But I'll just tell you one of the things I mean, you asked what, you know, what's in her thesis that got them so upset. They didn't seem to get upset about those things because they never even mentioned them. It's the remarkable thing is you got the article in The Australian 2 days after news of her PhD was made public. So people read the article in The Australian, a highly biased article, and assumed that the thesis is no good. They hadn't read the thesis, of course.
Of course.
At the time. And none of them that I could see, you know, like hundreds of comments, online comments following the article. They're just condemning the university by and large. They're not actually addressing any of the points in her thesis. So it's...
They're not interested in that, Brian. They just go on the attack of the individual. They don't want to read anything. That's not important for them. You know,
and
that's what they do.
That's well. That was what they did in this case,
yep.
And it's rather. I mean, one of the things that strikes me is that here I am. I'm in the university. I've supervised, you know, 20 plus PhD students. A lot of them on controversial topics, and you know, none of those generated very much interest. But suddenly, there's this, you know, one on this particular topic. And because there's an organized group that's trying to suppress any criticism of a vaccination policy, then they go out and they just, might say, disregard any of the sort of academic approaches to this, because a PhD thesis is a very serious piece of academic work. But rather than using the academic approach, which would be to write to the author and present criticisms and invite a response, or to...
Exactly.
Send an article to a, you know, a scholarly journal saying, yes, here's this thesis, and we disagree with the conclusions, and we think there's some flaws here. You know, that's, I'd say, yeah, that's fair enough. No one's going to get excited about that. But instead, they go straight to the mass media. They have highly misleading claims about the thesis, taking statements out of context, and just dismissing it, and then presenting themselves as the judges of the thesis, even though they've been campaigning for years against the thesis before they even saw it. I mean, this is the strange thing.
Well, they're trolls, Brian. They're just trolls.
Well, I'm not... I would take a different view on this, and this is stop the AVN people, and, you know, we don't have very much evidence about who they are and what they do.
Got some...
We can observe their behavior.
It's building, Brian. Yeah, it's building. Yes. A lot of people are out there know about them. Yeah.
But here would be my view is we've got two sides of this debate, and both sides are concerned about children's health, but they have different views about how to do that. You've got the ones who are pro-vaccination, thinking vaccination is going to benefit children. And you've got the critics of vaccination who say, well, maybe some of the vaccines, or all of them, depending on the person, may not be so beneficial. We better rethink. So both sides are concerned about children's health. And the only difference what we've got here is the Stop the AVN group, is that they've decided the way to proceed is to try and censor and ridicule anyone who takes a view contrary to theirs. So I'd say the difference is not just that they're trolls, that might be their behavior, but I think you can say their motivations might be just the same as those they're attacking, but the methods that they're using, namely censorship, are quite different.
I have to suggest that there is a little bit more difference. And that is, first of all, we understand that the amount of direct sales money involved in people who do or do not adopt the vaccination model for themselves and their children is enormous. And then the amount of money that's involved, and there's no getting around this, the amount of money involved in the downstream market, which is the diseases, conditions, and problems that result from the vaccination process, is almost incalculably huge. So we're talking about marketing via fear, intimidation, distortion, deceit, business as usual for corporate marketing and for public policy marketing that supports corporate marketing. But there is another factor here. You assume that the motivation of both sides is the same. Having been very close to the examination of what's going on and who's funding it and so on, not just in vaccines, but in a whole bunch of public policy, let's be very generous and call them public policy errors in major areas like genetically modified food or so-called food approved without safety studies, specifically because with safety studies it couldn't be approved, and others similar. I do not assume that the motivation is the same. The World Health Organization, which receives about 70% of its funding directly from the pharmaceutical industry, which may help to account for the fact that it's never met a vaccine that it didn't like. The World Health Organization, Gavi, the Gates Foundation, etc., do not have the same motivation, because although they talk a good rhetoric job about children's health, the reality is that these organizations have publicly announced, and my organization, the Natural Solutions Foundation, has published many of their documents. They've publicly announced their intention to reduce the population of the planet. And you will remember that in an easily available TED talk, Bill Gates, who is not a minor player in this situation, has said, quote, this is a direct quote, properly used, vaccines can reduce the population 12 to 15%. Well, if you want to reduce the population through vaccination, and we have to remember that the WHO founded a committee at the request of the United Nations in 1974 to find vaccines that reduce infertility, and this same organization was convicted in 1994 of genocide in the Philippines for using this unannounced on 3 million plus Filipinas, then we don't have equal motivation. Gee, everybody's really interested in the well-being of children, but we're just going about it differently. We have quite a different motivation. Got to get those vaccines in there so that the consequences, the downstream consequences, can be brought about. That's a fairly malevolent version of we've got to take care of children.
Well, perhaps I could say we can agree to disagree about that, and I should probably spell out my own position in this, which is that I don't really have a strong view about vaccination. I mean, I'm a social scientist, which means I investigate, analyze, study social dynamics of not just society, but in particular scientific controversies. And so my interest is in what's going on in terms of the debate. And I don't, unlike a lot of others in the debate, and nearly everyone else has a strong view about vaccination, but I don't. And it's actually, as a sociologist, it's quite convenient not to have a strong view, because then I can look at it, I think, with a bit more distance.
That's important, Brian. I agree with you there. Yeah, it's good that we get all these people like yourself on board. And because I think, you know, you've said that as well, Dr. Rima. You know, at the end of the day, you can have, you know, if you want to vaccinate, if you don't, Brian, that's completely up to you. But to lose that choice in this country, and we've said it many times, the Australian government, this is utter discrimination, what's going on against our children, and what I've seen going on in the media is despicable. And what they're doing is they're making life so hard that vaccines are becoming unavoidable for most families because they don't feel like they have a choice. And the media is treating hardworking, good Australian families like they're using, Brian, the word terrorist now. Dr. Rima got involved with that on the Sunday Telegraph with Claire Harvey. She called anti-vaxxers baby killers and terrorists. First it was deniers, but now they're actually slipping the terrorist word in. And I am not kidding. They're doing it on nightly shows now. and they're spreading propaganda as well, but they're not openly debating us. And for me, I agree with both of you, and I don't want to vaccinate my child. I've done my research, but I think here as well, Brian, we need all sides to come in here and have a good look at this, because we're getting bamboozled here.
I really want to make a clarification. I am in no way being contentious with you, Brian, and I understand that as a social scientist, you are observing the process, the debate, and the procedures, not taking sides on the scientific controversy. I got that, and that's perfectly fine. What I'm saying is that I think your implication of benign motivation changes the debate somewhat, and it's an assumption. I think that the facts, and we've published the data, the documents from the organizations that we're talking about, not the Australian Skeptic Attack Organization, but the, shall we say, the big guys behind many of these attacks, their motivation is in no way benign. Their motivation has been made very clear. People have a hard time actually believing it because it's so hideous. But it's not a benign motivation where it's just a matter of difference of opinion about how we should take care of the children. And that makes a huge difference when we try to understand who they are, what they are doing, and what tactics are they content to use. So I think it's an important clarification. You can assume that their motivations are benign and equivalent to other people's, but without documentation, that's not necessarily a correct assumption, and it changes the debate.
Yep. I mean, I would say I don't really have enough information about people's motivations to make a comment, and so my preliminary hypothesis is that everyone has the best of intentions. But perhaps I should comment about the issue of decision-making about vaccination, decision-making in terms of policy. And one of the things that happens in a lot of public debates is that the members of the public are not brought in to be involved in decision-making. In other words, the government, typically, influenced by various lobby groups and so forth, makes a decision. They consult their experts, and you know, away it goes. But there's a different sort of approach, which is to say, policy is about issues which involve not only science but also exercise of power and ethical issues should be ones that have an input from members of the general public because they're the ones being affected by it. And one of the things that's influenced me a lot is the idea of citizens' panels or citizens' juries. And one of the ways this operates is you randomly select, let's say, a dozen, just like a criminal jury. You randomly select 12 members of the public, and you can do a stratified sample, so you make sure you got half male, half female, and different occupational levels or other things. And then bring these people together and give them a bunch of information on both sides of an issue and let them hear from partisans and experts on both sides. And then this policy jury, they sit there and discuss the issues and come up with a set of recommendations about what the policy should be. Now, there have been hundreds of these sort of things run around the world in the past few decades, and they're, you might say, citizen participation at its best, and they're very, very satisfying for those that are involved. And my view is not to say, whether my view is for or against vaccination and so forth. I'd say I'm not really concerned about that. I would be happy if this sort of approach was used on vaccination or on other issues, and I'd be listening very carefully to what this randomly selected group of citizens would come up with. And of course, you don't have to just have one group, you could have lots of groups doing similar things. But this is very, very far off the agenda.
God.
And so what we've got at the moment is politicians being driven by lobby groups
Yes.
to impose policy and to squelch those who criticize it. And so it's, to my mind, it's a rather sad situation where there's a possibility of having citizen participation, which would actually might find a way around this or a way between the contesting parties. But in fact, what's going on is simply...
It's no fairness.
It's actually provoking greater dispute.
It is, Brian. Yeah, it is. I've seen on the media they're turning people against each other, Dr. Emma, you know, like this whole keep your kid away from mine and all this. This is terrible, Brian, and it's not fixing anything. So it's really despicable what's going on. I think it feels like it's sort of got worse. We're not having any open debates, as you just discussed, in this country. It's just this whole fear pumping. The media's just pumping fear and propaganda. And people are getting bamboozled by this and don't know which way to turn. And it's becoming a real mess. And, you know, I think it's sad. You know, I really do. Because I think, like you, you know, you don't have to be for or against vaccines. It's a human rights issue now, you know. You can't come in and do what they've done. It's really unethical and ridiculous what's happened. It's so extreme what's happened in this country. My mind boggles, Brian. I'm really shocked at what this government has done. And a lack of debate in regards to this.
To look for a way through the Gordian knot that's been created here, I would suggest that your Constitution already has proposed the way. And it's as I understand the law, it's actually not open for debate. And that is that the right of informed consent, which is the right of refusal, is already firmly established. So people can make their own citizen decisions on the basis of their own human rights. There is no right of the government to take away the right of the citizen that is enshrined in international law and in national law. I mean, the words of the Australian Constitution are basically lifted directly from the Geneva Convention language, which Australia is bound by international treaty to uphold. So citizens can have their debates, and I hope they will, and parents can have their deliberations, and I hope they will, but the right of the individual to make that decision, a wise decision, a foolish decision, a semi-wise, semi-foolish decision, whatever, is entirely non-debatable. So what the Parliament has done and what is happening in the United States and in other places rapidly, and that's something that we deal with in the Natural Solutions Foundation a lot, what the Parliament has done is create an unlawful law that, in fact, cannot be upheld under the Constitution or under international law. And that's fairly interesting in terms of public policy. That means that somebody in the public policy world has to have noticed that what they're being, what they're promulgating violates fundamental foundational rights and yet is being brought forward anyway. I find that fascinating.
I think you're right, Dr. Emma, but as well, Brian, I think it's starting to come out. What do you think? I sent you a paper. Someone put it up on Facebook. It was from the newspapers over in Western Australia by Steve Grant. We're just trying to find the actual article online, but it says here, this was from the main papers, the Turnbull government's punitive approach to enforcing mandatory vaccination breaches children's rights, but the Human Rights Commission in this country remains silent on the issue. Human rights experts expert Paula Gerber, a professor at Monash University, told the Herald this week it was clear the withholding of financial entitlements from parents who refuse to inoculate their children breaches numerous articles of the United Nations Convention on the Rights of the Child. So what do you think is going to happen here, Brian, in regards to this and this breaching and this discrimination against our children, the government sort of pushed through, as you said before, with no sort of public input at all. They just rushed through these laws. Where do you think we can sort of take this, Brian, in regards to our rights and laws and what Dr. Rima just discussed and they're talking about in these papers now? We are getting it, starting to get this mainstream. What can we do, Brian? Because, you know, you're obviously involved, and I think what the university did in Wollongong there was incredible. And I know you're also sort of juggling there, because I read, you know, what do the university do? They get attacked, so do they pull the paper? Because if the university pulls the paper out, which they can't do, but if they did, then what does that say about the university and our the state of our universities in this country? What do you think about that, Brian? Where do we go here? We're in a rock and a hard place, aren't we, in between?
First, I might say I'm not speaking on behalf of the university. I'm just a member of staff, but I've been very pleased with the position taken by the University of Wollongong
in relation to
this thesis. But let me take a different perspective to the issue of, you know, you might say human rights and the various laws and so forth that can be used in this. My approach to this is rather different, and it's to look at strategies, namely the plans and goals and methods that are used by different groups to try and achieve their ends. And so I've looked at, to some extent, at strategies by both sides in this debate. So if we, just to, for the sake of argument, let's look at the strategy of those who are promoting vaccination. And we've already talked about the Stop the Australian Vaccination Network sort of approach, which is about trying to censor and discredit any criticism. But there are others who are much more, you might say, much more balanced and mainstream, who are simply trying to encouraging doctors to talk rationally and, you know, compassionately with parents and to work out the best way, perhaps to convince them that vaccination is a good thing, but not to try and force it on them. And there's actually quite a lot of people from the mainstream medical approach who are critical of some of the new laws, the no jab, no pay laws, and they might think to be actually counterproductive. So that's from the point of view of promoting vaccination. For those who are critical of vaccination or pro-choice, and they're largely coming under attack, and so then the question is, what can they do? And I've been researching for a long time, you might say, tactics, namely methods, to challenge injustice. And what happens when there's a powerful group that is doing something that other people see as unjust? Let's say it's torture or beating up protesters, whatever. Then they do a number of things. Pardon me. And one of them is to cover up what they're doing, hide it from others. Second one is to devalue the target. Third one is to explain it away in various ways. Then a fourth one is what I call official channels. So you set up an official channel, which can be a government agency, ombudsman, a law, politician, grievance procedure. And people think once we've got an official channel, we've got some formal procedure to address something, such as the courts, then everything is going to be okay because those things are providing justice. Well, they do in many cases, but when a powerful group is breaking the law or doing something bad, the official channels usually provide only an appearance of justice. And so I've been recommending to say, yes, don't assume that, you know, just trying to challenge the law, challenge the agencies and so forth, is the way forward on this. Because I did a chapter in one of my books just published last year, and I looked at the Australian Vaccination Network strategies, and one of its strategies is a court challenge to the Healthcare Complaints Commission. And that was all very well, and I was very surprised they actually won the court challenge. But then what happened is the government went and changed the law so that they could just carry on doing what they were doing otherwise. So I'm very skeptical of trying to use the law as the main avenue when it's your group is relatively powerless compared to those on the other side. And so I'd be saying,
I think in general that's a very wise skepticism, but this is a rather special situation. There is local law, state law, national law, and then there is treaty law, which supersedes state law, national law. And in treaty law, a country is forced to, is compelled to, has no choice but to abide by whatever that treaty law says. Now, the country can choose to violate the treaty, but there are standards and there are remedies beyond, and this is the important point, beyond the corrupt local situation. There are international courts and so on. But the point, and the Natural Solutions Foundation, of which I am the medical director, and our main website is Dr. Rima Truth Reports. That's D-R-R-I-M-A, Truth Reports. What we've done is studied international treaty law, humanitarian law, and we've discovered that every country in the world is bound by the right of informed consent wording and law if they have ratified the Geneva Convention. Now, what that means is that although the country may be corrupt and the legal status may be very badly applied for the justice in any situation to assert itself, the individual, the doctor, the paramedic, the nurse, the hospital administrator, etc., who violates this international treaty law, is him or herself personally liable for criminal and civil charges. Now, that's a level of power that protesters and injustice contenders rarely have. This is a special situation, and this is a consequence directly of the Nuremberg trials and the subsequent trials out of World War II. So in this one particular situation, it doesn't matter if Australia tries to change the law. They have tried to change the law, saying, well, if you don't take the jab, we don't have to pay you. The people who are so violated actually have the right to go to the international courts of human rights and justice. That's a whole different level. But the fact is that the person who violates it in Australia at the local down and dirty syringe in hand level, that person is now liable for criminal prosecution in a whole different way. And to deal with this, we have created the Advanced Vaccine Directive card, which gives the bearer, it's kind of like a legal bearer bond, but you have to sign it, which gives the bearer a statement of informed consent assertion. And under international and national law, informed consent can be deemed waived by any authority if the individual does not assert it properly. And so this simple card, signed and dated, actually asserts it according to international law in a correct way. That's pretty powerful. Will it work every single time? Nope. But the people who have this right, which is properly asserted, violated, then have huge legal action available to them against the violator. Pretty powerful. And you can see administrators and paramedics and nurses and doctors backing off saying, whoa, I don't want to be involved in this. I'm not going to vaccinate. I can see that happening. I'm sure you can too. This is a powerful option.
Okay, well, I can understand what you're trying to do, but let me present a contrasting point of view, and that's to look at the at a movement, or you might say people with a common goal. And in this case, we're going to look at the the vaccine critics in Australia and to say, what's the way that's going to get more of them organized and active and trying to pursue their agendas? And in looking at social movements more generally, the goal should be to develop campaigns which allow more people to participate.
And I absolutely agree. Completely and totally.
So the,
but it's the only one.
The difficulty with using the law or using any of the official channels is that the main participants are lawyers or other experts and so forth, and so they don't really have the same sort of opportunities for people to get directly involved. And that's I'd see as a problem there. But I might just mention that in some ways the problems for the pro-vaccination crowd are more serious than they are for the critics. The critics are being attacked and they're being demonized,
yeah,
and they know what they're up against, and yet it's fairly difficult for them. But the pro-vaccination people, if we look at the mainstream medical establishment, they're in this curious situation in that there's a populist push, which has been triggered by Stop the AVN, to censor any criticism and to demonize anyone who actually speaks out. And yet, if you look at the history of vaccination, that whenever vaccination has become compulsory, it's generated huge popular opposition. So actually trying to censor the opponents might be counterproductive.
I agree.
And certainly, it's some of my research with Sue Curry-Jansen has been on how censorship can backfire. Namely, sometimes censorship leads to more attention to the thing being censored.
Yes.
And we certainly see that with Judy Wileyman's thesis.
Yeah.
If the seven opponents had simply ignored it, said nothing at all, it'd be sitting there on the university website and read by only a handful. But instead, it's one of the most highly downloaded theses on the whole site, and it's generated a whole bunch of attention that might not otherwise have come there. So you've got this strange thing. The pro-vaccination people who are in the mainstream might be saying, oh, my gosh, this Stop the AVN people are really wrecking it for us because they're stirring up the pot so much, they're generating a lot of opposition, and we might have calm and sensible ways of promoting vaccination, but they're being upstaged by seven and by politicians who are just going along with this sort of, you know, with the seven agenda, and the whole, you know, the sort of normal way of promoting vaccination is being undermined, being sabotaged. And I think this one of the things that might change is when some people in the establishment decide that, this is too much, this is not a good way to proceed, and start speaking out about it.
Yes.
But I don't see that happening very soon, because the Stop the AVN people will attack anyone who criticizes the way they proceed. So it's even the people in the establishment would be afraid to, or many of them would be afraid to criticize.
This Stop the AVN, Ryan, but also I've said, I think what happened is they've kind of opened up a Pandora's box, haven't they, as you just explained. If they hadn't have done anything, it's just changed so much because of what the government's done, and this box has been opened, and I just don't think it's going to be shut, and I think more people are coming on board. But this group you talk about here, what where are they getting their power? Because it's interesting, if you look on Judy's thesis, she talks about the Australian government and this global alliance, she talks about the International Monetary Fund and this Federation of Pharmaceutical Manufacturers. She talks about the United Nations Development Fund and these private research groups, and she mentions the Bill and Belinda Gates Foundation, the Rockefeller Foundation, the United Nations and all this, this is a lot of power as well. She mentions in the thesis that it is so important in Australia and America, I guess everywhere that's having this problem, that we need this independent research to be carried out, you know. We need this independent research to be done on to look at how many vaccines are being recommended for our children and if they truly are effective and necessary. to protect the community. Because as I said, a lot of these morning breakfast shows and TV shows and newspapers, they're not putting out actual articles. I mean, a lot of these articles coming out of the Rupert Murdoch press don't have any bearing in any reality, as far as I'm concerned. They're just name-calling and vicious, nasty pieces, and they don't offer any actual facts or science to back up anything that they're saying. They're just attacking people and calling anti-vaxxers hippies and mung bean eaters and toothless because they're meth addicts and all this, Brian. Utterly insulting people, but they don't offer anything. But Judy states it here in her thesis about this control, Dr. Emma and Brian, and I wonder, can we actually get any critical debate on this, Brian, and a fair go on this? Because as you said, these people just step in, bully and intimidate everybody out of the picture. It's shocking, really.
What I might say is there's quite a number of scientific controversies that become highly polarized. And the, you know, I've studied the fluoridation debate, for example, and fluoridation or vaccination, whatever. It's very hard to find anyone who sits there in the middle and who dispassionately examines the arguments on both sides.
That's right. We're missing that, aren't we? Yeah.
We're missing that. And the more the attacks go on, I mean, I do know one or two people who are in the middle, you might say, taking a middle position on vaccination, but no one wants to hear them because the two sides are so locked in battle that they don't want someone who's taking a, you might say, a compromise or an intermediate position, because it's they need to be, you know, gearing up to counter those on the opposite side. And so it's very, very difficult. And I know from personal experience and more than one debate that if you try and take a you might say, a neutral position, you'll be taken up by one side or the other. And so, you know, but I knew this would happen when I got involved with the vaccination debate, is that even though I don't take a position on vaccination, that because I was defending free speech for one side, then I'd come under attack by the pro-vaccination people. And no surprise there. But it is rather disappointing that people try and classify you. They try and they put a label on you so they can dismiss you. And I'll just say one other thing, which is not surprising, but still a bit disappointing, is that I've looked through a lot of the writings on both sides of this debate, and the pro-vaccination people, they present their viewpoint, and they lay it out, and they present the arguments, and the vaccine critical people do the same, but hardly ever do I see anyone on either side reasonably presenting the opposite side. In other words, you could say the vaccine critical people could say, oh, here's the arguments for vaccination, and lay them out, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And these are the strongest arguments we found on their side, and now we're going to analyze them. Doesn't happen very often, but just the same on the other. I've seen all of the pro-vaccination people, and they're attacking the critics. They look for weaknesses. They attack weaknesses. They pull statements out of context and attack them. They ridicule people. Hardly ever do I see anyone on the pro-vaccination side reasonably summing up what the arguments are from the vaccine critical perspective, which is just a symptom of the polarization of the debate. Namely, there's the two sides, and never the twain shall meet. They can't even recognize what the other side is trying to say because they're so intent on trying to discredit it. Like I say, that's probably the biggest disappointment for me, is that it's so hard to do that, and probably that so few people are interested, and that perhaps they're not interested because no one's going to listen.
I feel like that's what we're trying to do now, Brian, and the idea came up to us to actually do a show, and because no one will debate Dr. Reamer and they won't debate us at all, we thought we would basically set someone up with all the questions that the pro vaccination movement have, the people who want the vaccines, these groups, whoever they are. We would go through a whole list, as you said, of all their comments, anything we can think of to support vaccines, and we would do a show and ask them to Dr. Reamer here. You know what I mean? Sort of like have our own debate. So we're actually looking at setting that up, which will be very interesting, and we'll get the person to go into actor mode and really put forward, all these pro-vaccination ideas to the doctor, and so she can answer them. And I think that's it matches up with what you just stated. So that's a good thing that we can do in regards to this, because I think, as you said, we're missing that critical middle point, and nobody's listening there, and it's just becoming a slanging match. And with the media throwing fuel on the fire, as I said, it's getting much worse. And I've spoken to people in tears about this. I spoke to a homeopath the other week, Brian, who said she's getting young women in who are in tears because they're worried about vaccines. It's not so much they're anti-vaccine or against it, it's just that they've looked into it and they're worried, and they don't want to vaccinate their babies, and they're scared, and so they've gone the view that I have. I've gone with homeoprophylaxis because I've studied it, and that's what I use for my baby, and that's my right. It's your right to go and vaccinate your children, Brian. It's Dr. Rima's right to do what she wants to do. It's everybody's right to do that, but, you know, that's the saying. I'm just saying, she said that these people are coming in tears because the family are reading the papers and they're going along with this, and they're worried that their own husband and families are going to viciously attack them if they choose not to vaccinate the child. So it's almost causing divorce here. You know, and this is it's compounding, and it's a real worry, you know, because the real science isn't coming out, and that middle debate, as you said, where people can just take what they want and do what they want to do, it's all fear mongering, as far as I can see.
In some way, there is no debate. That is because if there is a risk, there must be a choice. So, as a fundamental human rights principle. Now, if there's a risk, for instance, to 76 doses of vaccines before the age of 18, and to, according to the new Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices report that or recommendations that came out a couple of days ago in the United States, in which a person who lives to the age of 80 would receive not only those 76 vaccines, but an additional 124 vaccines. The risk is not incremental, it's exponential with additional vaccine doses. And so whether you like vaccines or don't like vaccines, whether you believe that the science supports them or not, becomes at one level irrelevant when you realize that there is an acknowledged risk that the United States Supreme Court and other courts have affirmed that, in the United States this is, have affirmed that vaccines are, and I quote, unavoidably unsafe. And so if you're trying to mandate unavoidably unsafe procedures without any opportunity to avoid the unavoidable unsafeness of the procedure, you are violating rights at such a level that the scientific part of the debate is irrelevant. We're not talking about science here. We're talking about agendas, that whether it's the financial agenda or whether it's the depopulation agenda or whether it's some other agenda, the chipping agenda, whatever the agenda is, it's being imposed on people through risky realities, and they simply have to have the right to make the choice about whether they want to accept the risk. That's completely separate from whether you like the science of vaccines or not. And I think that that's too often lost, or it's seen as a secondary issue. It's not secondary at all.
I might just comment on one of the other features of the Australian vaccination debate, which does seem to be unique in the world, as far as I know.
Yeah.
And that is, it's the concept of a moral panic, namely an alarm about something that actually is not, shouldn't be a cause for alarm at all. And what you got in Australia, according to the people who know about this, is that vaccination rates are high and stable. In other words, there's no particular danger from declining vaccination. And yet you've got the Stop the AVN people drumming up this giant fear, not just a fear of people who aren't vaccinated, but a fear of anyone who actually criticizes vaccination. So it's, you know, so there's no particular danger. There's not a large number of people dying from infectious diseases, and there's no particular danger that the vaccination levels are going to drop. And yet you've got this huge campaign focusing on something that's not even a problem. And so I have to say, what's going on here? Is this a distraction from something that's more serious? I mean, we know that iatrogenic disease, side effects of medical interventions, such as, you know, being given the wrong drugs and that sort of thing, kills a huge number of people every year in Australia and elsewhere. That's not on the agenda. Why don't we have a panic about the number of mistakes in hospitals and so forth? Well, it's that's a wider question than what I could address here, but I do say perhaps the intense focus on vaccination as an issue might be a distraction from something that should be getting more attention, and that might be other ways to improve the health of children. Might be, let's say, improving nutrition, reducing the poverty levels, things that actually might challenge a few people who are in power, challenge the social order in some way, because we know the food manufacturers and the high degree of inequality in Australia are built into the society in certain ways, that those things might be better ways to actually try and improve the health of children. But instead we have this massive discussion about vaccination, which in some ways I see as a bit of a distraction.
Seems like that, Ryan. Yeah.
I agree with you completely, absolutely and completely and totally. And I would take it one step further and say, can we, by examining the output of the organizations that are participating in the panic and the program, deduce what the purpose of this distraction is, or what the purpose of this misdirection is? And I believe that we can. I believe, as I said before, that it's been made very, very clear that there are other agendas, that there are other intentions in the vaccination programs, and they're not necessarily benign, and those are relevant. It's not just something for next week. We'll think about it later. They are very relevant as we think about public policy and as we think about why the resources are not being committed to the only things that have historically ever reduced morbidity and mortality, which turns out to be hygiene, sanitation, improved diet, clean water. These are the things that have always reduced incidence of disease. And the graphs I presented an invited paper at the first All India Medical Education Congress in Mangalore on February 9th last year at NETI University, and I presented some of the very, very same documentation and statistics that Judy's thesis makes use of, because they're publicly available. And the next day, the largest newspaper in India, The Hindu, was calling for the government of India to revoke my license. Small structural problem, the government of India didn't grant my license. The state of New York, the state of Connecticut, and the state of Washington did. But never mind reality here. That's the degree of frantic censorship, the knee-jerk response that somebody's agenda has been used or has been allowed to put resources into developing. That's not a debate. That's basically a fundamentally insane lack of debate, lack of thought. And it comes about because somebody wants it that way. Some several somebodies want it that way. And we have to ask why and who and how. Otherwise, we're not going to solve it at the citizen level.
Not in Australia. Dr. Emma, I'll ask Brian about, before we pack up, the media here, and that article I mentioned earlier on, Brian, from Western Australia, from the Fremantle Herald, talking about Professor Gerber. She was talking in her paper about the Victorian government's policy, for example, about the child cares and daycare, from, you know, banning these children, which is discriminating against the child. And she's saying that the article she wrote on this about Victorian school ban was rejected by four mainstream media outlets before it was picked up by Al Jazeera in Qatar. So this is incredible stuff. And she's saying that the human rights commissioners here, they're completely ignoring this, and they're not getting involved at all. You know, we have overseas media that has to pick up what's going on in Australia because our own media are utterly refusing to report on it. And it's totally one-sided and biased. I watch it on these shows, Brian, these morning breakfast shows. They keep having these so-called vaccine debates, and they've got someone who wants vaccines, and they've got a columnist from the Murdoch media saying, yes, vaccinate, don't let kids go to school on the bus. And there's no debate, and our papers aren't... I mean, for me, the media should be, as you said, Brian, in the middle here and at least looking at both sides, but they're not at all. Have you found that, Brian, that the media are doing this? They're not looking at both critical sides evenly, that it's more the push for vaccines that they're focusing on?
That's a very challenging question. Probably would require a long answer because there's lots of things going on in the media, but I might just comment that the attack on Judy Wileyman's thesis has been primarily driven through The Australian, and most of the other mass media have not picked up on it very much. Mm. So, but the other thing, which I knew in principle, namely that the media drive the agendas for discussion. Yeah, there's a lot of research showing that media sets the agenda for what people talk about. Not necessarily tell people what to think, but what to think about. But what is rather very apparent from the articles in The Australian and all the subsequent comment is how many people just go along with the agenda. They don't, in other words, the articles there attacking the thesis, and you know, and then loads and loads of commenters just take that as the gospel and just then draw the conclusion, yes, the university's corrupt or, you know, negligent or whatever. Just totally absurd conclusions with insufficient evidence.
They don't step back and say, hang on, I'm going to go and personally read this paper, whether I agree with vaccines or not, and I'm going to have a critical viewpoint here. They just attack. Yeah.
Now there's a very worthwhile book called Think Freaky, which is basically one of the arguments of the authors is to say, you should often say, more often say, I don't know. So if you don't have enough evidence about something, rather than jumping to one side or the other, which is what most people do, is simply say, I don't know. And my lesson, one of the lessons I learned from this attack, is that if I read something in the newspaper and I have no personal knowledge about it, I haven't studied it myself, I'm going to withhold judgment, because just because the media story presents a particular angle on it, that doesn't necessarily mean that's the angle that I should be going along with. Not very easy to follow, and probably in many cases I personally won't be able to do that, but that's certainly the lesson here, is that it's very easy to get drawn into media agendas, and those media agendas are driven by particular vested interests or campaigning groups in many cases, and so you've got the media serving as a tool for groups with agendas, and just need to be careful not to be sucked into that process.
Yeah.
Which, of course, requires an educational program in the schools that teaches inconvenient skills if you wish to dominate people. Those inconvenient skills include critical thinking. They include logic, formal and systemic logic. It includes teaching the ethos of asking questions as a way of making decisions rather than adopting authority as a way of making decisions. And I'm sure that as a sociologist looking at these issues, you must be very, very deeply steeped in the educational processes that do and do not result in this kind of critical evaluation and withholding of immediate judgment and so on.
Yeah.
Yes, thank you.
Nice said. We might pack it up for today, Brian, but it's good to have you on, and I think if you look at what we're doing now with the doctor and yourself and myself being a researcher, and I think looking at the whole thing myself, I try to take a fly on the wall view at it, Brian, and you know, look at both sides as well, although I am against you know, what's going on, and I don't vaccinate myself. That's my private views, but I think what we're allowing now with you and what we've done today is this critical viewpoint and get your ideas on everything and the paper as well, so very important. So where do you see us going, Brian? Where do you want to finish? Is there anything you want to say before we pack up here today? Are you seeing a positive sort of positive sort of movement out of all this that it's happening? What are your plans in moving forward?
There's a positive side to this for me, and also for Judy. We've already talked about the fact that her thesis is getting a lot more attention than it.
Yeah, it's great. Yeah,
and I should say that the attacks on me have led a whole bunch of people contact me to say, "Good on you for defending academic freedom," and I've got people contacting me telling me about their interest in various other unorthodox topics.
Sort of attacks on you, Brian. Have you had like sort of nasty sort of attacks from these people, or how's it been?
Oh, just it's the normal sort of social media
bullying,
verbal abuse.
Yep.
But which doesn't bother me in the slightest.
No,
but,
just cowards.
But,
yeah.
But it's what's interesting is that by focusing on me as a supervisor, even though the people know nothing at all about what I do as a supervisor. But it's generated more interest in my work.
Nice.
And all I can say is, let's go for it and take advantage of the fact that you get a bit of publicity. Because it's not necessarily always going to be bad.
No, they've helped promote our websites as well, so thanks for that. But I think, as you said, you're right. This has put the spotlight on Judy's piece more, and I'm seeing it everywhere, and we're pushing it around the world as well. On our ends, I mean, Dr. Rima's Natural Solution Facebook page is going on 110,000 people liking that. I think they could hit 200,000 people in not too much time. So, and I put up one story, Brian, on my website in regards to one of these issues, and it got 20,000 people on there in 1 week. So, you know, we're seeing a huge amount of all sorts of different people. Dr. Rima works with lawyer Ralph Fusitola and the Natural Solutions Foundation. We have you at the university and so many people helping us now. And I feel positive about this, Brian, that we can make some positive steps here and get this sort of middleman, as you say, out of the closet a bit more and get more of a debate going here. On what's really happening, because I think it's pretty grubby what's going on. I think it's really low what happened there, and to attack Judy on her thesis, as you said, when people don't even read something, that really disgusts me on a personal note, you know, that people don't even bother to read something. They just follow the herd and go in and just attack people. It's a really low thing to do, and I think if this has shined a spotlight on your work, that can only be a great thing. And you also have a great blog as well. Should we mention your blog as well, Brian?
Well,
is there something you want to mention, or is there anything you want to plug?
Just to say, all of my research is available on my website, and just put my name into the search engine.
Yeah.
And get to my website.
It's a good little blog. Yeah, you've got a lot of info on there. I want people to have a look, have a read. Yeah, so I'll put that up today.
Very good.
For you. Is that all, Dr. Rima? You want to finish on something before we wrap up the show today?
Yes. I want to finish on the fact that, first of all, our website is Dr. Rima Truth Reports, DRRIMA, truthreports.com. Our Facebook page is Natural Solutions Foundation. I urge you to go there, like it, and disseminate it. We use it to put out a great deal of information very rapidly. We also, when you put your email information in Dr. Rima Truth Reports, we'll send you a copy or we'll subscribe you to our newsletter. And there's a lot of information because this is a very active area. Your rights are under tremendous attack. And I'd like to have you sharing that information as we put it out. Now, the other thing that I want to say is that, to echo something that we've heard, when people take the responsibility and acquire the information necessary to make decisions and share that information with others, and then act definitively on the basis of what they want to do, the world changes. Why does the world change? Because, believe it or not, the power is actually with us. The power lies in our hands. And when we definitively say yay or nay in large numbers in an appropriate format, we change national and international policy. How do I know that's true? Because the Natural Solutions Foundation has succeeded on numerous occasions in doing exactly that by saying, collectively, because your voice alone will not do it, but collectively, by saying the three most important words of a free person to a regulator or a decision maker. Those words are, don't you dare. Because when we sufficiently mean it and act on it, amazingly, astonishingly, they don't dare. They will come back. They will try again. They're like cockroaches. You can irradiate them. They come back. You can poison them. They come back. They will come back. But each time they come back, our international and national and state policy impact has shown us that we're stronger and they are not. So this is quite literally, as I see it, a battle for not only our freedom, but a battle for our lives. And the intermediary is our health. This is health freedom, your most fundamental freedom. And if you do nothing, it will be taken from you, inevitably. If you do defend it by taking legal, appropriate, and effective action, then I believe that we all have a chance to protect each other. And it's not through putting poisons in our body.
That's right. And, you know, your body is not owned by any pharmaceutical company or any government. It is your body, and it's ultimately, at the end of the day, your choice what goes in it and your children's bodies. You should not be forced in any way or told, you know, and it's up to you to do your own research in this life as a human being. Look at, you know, what you want to do and what you don't want to do, and it's your choice. So very important, Dr. Rima, and we couldn't do it without you, your tireless efforts. You give us hundreds, thousands of hours and documents and information. You never asked for a thing, so we couldn't do it without you. You are amazing. And Brian, thanks for all you do, and thanks for standing up. And we really needed Judy's thesis to go in there to the university, and I congratulate and commend the University of Wollongong for doing this. It's something we really needed to do, and it came out of the clear blue sky. And it doesn't matter whether you agree with the thesis or not. It needs to be in the public through the university for people to log on and have a look and make up their own decision, what they think about it, but not just rubbish it and not even read it. But thank you so much, Brian, for taking a stand and doing everything that you do, and we need people like you so much, you know, in this whole situation and in our country. So great work, and great work for Judy and the university. And we can catch up again soon, Brian, do another show with you, and I'd like to stay in contact and see how you are and how you're going, and follow your work. And
okay, just one comment is, I don't think we should thank the university in this case, because the university simply followed all its normal procedures.
Oh, that's good, Brian. I think that's good, yeah.
It wasn't especially doing anything for Judy more than any other student.
That's what I mean, yeah, but I think that's good. I worry that we're going to lose that in the universities. I was sort of on the opinion that universities would just sort of can something like that and you know, wouldn't give it a chance, but I'm just happy that it went through as it normally should in the right process, and that's what I'm happy about, yeah.
That's exactly what happened.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I know she's just submitted a paper and the university's done their job, and that's what we want. I'm happy about that. That gives me hope, Brian, that it's, they just didn't put it under a rug somewhere, and that's why I commend them. So great. Yeah, great work on all you guys. So thanks very much, Brian. Chat to you again soon, and keep up the great work.
Okay, thank you.
Good man. Thanks, Doc, and as usual.
Yeah. It was a pleasure.
Always good to have you, and we'll catch up again soon.
Indeed.